Occasionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're going to start out with some reporters' comments. And first, we talk to Dan Carton. He covers generally state house and Indiana state government news for the Times of Northwest Indiana. But he's been known to slip a few other topics in as well, too. And he's back up here in the region, I understand, doing some work. Thanks for being with us today, Dan.
Happy to be here.
I am figuring that a lot of the topics that you are probably covering, looking into, are ones that may be left over from the General Assembly, and the Hard Rock Casino Gary is one of them. Tell us about going to that informational session and what we've learned about that, so we know what's going to be happening there along 8094 someday.
Yeah, and like you said, this did grow out of the legislative session when they passed House and Rolled Act 1015, which opened the door for the Majestic Star Casinos on Lake Michigan to relocate to an inland location. And we've since learned through zoning records and now a meeting at the Gary Plan Commission that the new casino is going to be at 8094 and Burr Street, right off the highway there. So it'll be far more accessible than the Majestic Star is, and that it's also going to be a Hard Rock Casino. The Spectacle Entertainment, which owns the Majestic Star, said they partnered with Hard Rock because they wanted to partner with the best in the face of this expected new competition coming in Illinois. You'll recall that Illinois, the governor there, approved a measure for a Chicago casino and a South Suburban casino, and those are believed to be likely to cut into Northwest Indiana's casino take. So they think by making this a Hard Rock casino right off the Borman, very accessible to Illinoisans, that they'll still be able to compete and outperform those Illinois casinos just across the state line whenever those get built.
I understand that Hard Rock Casino has been a very solid, operation. They have one, I think, in Tampa, Florida, and they have others around the country, too, so it's not going to be just the first time that the Hard Rock has set up the casino here, and certainly not here in Gary. But we know anything more about what Spectacle Entertainment is relying on them to be able to do, other than just be some formidable competition to whatever is going to come across the state line?
Yeah, Hard Rock's actually going to brand the casino. Like you said, there are other Hard Rocks. There's 12 Hard Rock casinos, most with hotels. The mm-hmm. Gary one will have a hotel eventually. And it's going to have a Hard Rock Live concert venue, a Hard Rock Cafe restaurant. And, that Hard Rock name is extremely well known from people, going to Hard Rock restaurants, Hard Rock Cafes, and people who like music, which is, just about everybody. So they can get into the theme of the new casino. Hard Rock is well known as a good operator. The brand is actually owned by the Seminole Tribe of Florida, but the Spectacle will continue to own the Gary Casino, and Hard Rock will simply manage and run it. Typically Hard Rock casinos, they have the music memorabilia, they have kind of a fun theme, they have the music, so it'll be unlike anything else, certainly in this market. And really in this part of the country.
Yeah. It sounds like, too, that based on the information that you had in your story about the fact that since they're going to have a live venue planned for this facility, they're really going to give the Hammond Casino a run for its money.
Yeah, that's you can see Hammond has closed the venue while they renovate it and try and make it a better concert venue. And really, there really hasn't been a large live performance space in this area since the Star Plaza closed in Merrillville. Mm-hmm. So there is a need for this type of venue, and being closer to Chicago than Merrillville, not that I-65 was that far to get to, but this would be, just a few exits across the state line. It'll be more likely to draw from that audience. And then also, people forget that the Gary casinos are so far north on Lake Michigan that people from southern Lake County are probably more likely to go to the Borman Expressway to gamble or take in a show or go to a restaurant just because it's 10, 15 miles closer than going all the way up to the lake.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right, too. Since you had a chance to look into the information that's before the Lake County Plan Commission, and more specifics are they talking about for this proposed site that they want to build there at the Borman and Burr Street?
Yeah, this is it's the Gary Plan Commission in the city of Gary. And Majestic or Spectacle has purchased a 27-acre plot that was owned by a truck stop company for possible future development. They bought the land. They're buying some nearby adjacent land, and they're still working on figuring out where everything is going to go on the site, but it will have approximately 200,000 square foot casino, and that's going to be on land, so you're not going to have, you know, multiple levels like you do on the boats. You're not going to have, you know, sort of the weird connections and having to take the elevator to go play a different game. It's all going to be laid out in one, you know, massive room with, you know, different areas. It's going to have the restaurants, it's going to have the bars, it's going to have a sports book, Hard Rock Cafe, the performance venue. And then that's going to be phase one, which they hope to open on December 31st, 2020. So you might be able to ring in New Year's Eve 2021 at this brand new casino.
Wow.
And then that's their goal. And then phase two is going to follow after that, and that's going to be a hotel and sort of a large parking garage. You know, people are going to be able to it's a big property, so there'll be parking there, but they want to, you know, connect everything together and make it all a seamless experience, and that's going to follow 2 to 3 years after the casino opens.
Well, it sounds like, too, that when they get that operation up and running, and obviously it's going to be a great boon not only to business along that corridor and to the city of Gary as well, it's going to be a great economic boon to the city because of the tax revenue they'll be able to draw from it.
Yeah, the casino will pay property taxes. The city will presumably get more money in wagering taxes and other related gaming taxes. Some of it they might have to share. The law that allowed the move requires Gary to share some of its revenue if it is taking a greater than expected amount from Hammond, Chicago, and Michigan City. But that's only going to be for a maximum of 4 years. So as a long-term investment, this will probably be very good for the city of Gary from a revenue standpoint, certainly much more than the Majestic Star has been in recent years.
One of the other stories that you've had out here recently in the Times, in print and online, is dealing with a man who we know, of course, is involved with a business organization here in Lake County. He's one of our state senators here. That's how I know that you get a chance to catch up with him often at the State House. But even though Senator Eddie Melton hasn't officially put himself out as a candidate for governor, you mentioned in your story that he certainly is acting like one. Tell us about all of the activities that he has been involved in here since the close of the General Assembly session.
Yeah, absolutely. State Senator Eddie Melton is a Democrat from Gary. You might know him from his work as a community service manager at NIPSCO, very much a part of the region, former member of the State Board of Education. He's been looking at a run for governor in 2020, run for the Democratic nomination. He announced in June at an event in Gary that he was thinking about it and said that he was going to go on a statewide listening tour to see what Hoosiers think about that idea. So far, he has been to Indianapolis, Lafayette, Fort Wayne, Evansville, as well as East Chicago, Valparaiso, and Michigan City, and he's got a bunch more stops coming up in the next, before Labor Day: South Bend, Hammond, Bloomington, Terre Haute, Brookville, Muncie, Anderson, and Jeffersonville. So he's really covering, you know, all four corners of the state and everything in between, getting a sense, meeting with voters, trying to see if, you know, maybe there's support out there for a Lake County Democrat to run for governor.
Yeah, you mentioned in your story the fact that he's really been doing a lot of these visits, and a lot of them, of course, are related to education. So that fits right in with his efforts as a state senator from Lake County to basically keep up on what's happening and people's opinions about educational issues.
Yeah, and kind of in a unique twist, the state superintendent of public instruction, Jennifer McCormick, who is a Republican, is attending some of these events with Senator Melton. She's actually going to be at his Hammond listening session on July 30th. So if you wanted to catch them together, you'd be able to do that. But it raised some eyebrows that the Republican state schools chief is potentially campaigning with a potential Democratic candidate for governor. But Jennifer McCormick isn't going to be on the ballot in 2020. If you remember, they made the office of state superintendent an appointed office starting in 2021. So she really has nothing to lose, since Governor Holcomb has pretty much suggested that he's not going to be appointing her. So she's out there talking about education alongside Senator Melton, who believes the Republican-controlled General Assembly shortchanged teachers and students in this last session by not putting enough money towards education, and especially not putting enough money into teacher pay raises.
I know that your story also talks in more detail, too, about some of the political party aspects of if a person runs, in this particular case, for governor, you can do the exploratory committee, which is what Senator Melton is doing right now. But then you have to do something entirely different based on state law if you do actually decide to get yourself into the campaign.
Yeah, that was the focus of my story, that he said in June that he was forming an official exploratory committee, and he didn't actually do that. Mm-hmm. He's so far running everything through his existing Senate campaign account, which under the law he technically is permitted to do. It just has raised some eyebrows among some Democrats wondering if this guy's actually a candidate for governor. Why hasn't he opened a gubernatorial campaign finance account? Senator Melton's strategist pointed out, I reported in my story, that they believe that they don't actually need to do that until he officially declares that he's a candidate for governor. And it appears, according to the Secretary of State's office, under Indiana law, that he is fine still just running everything through his Senate account, even though it does have different reporting deadlines. We found out, for example, how much Governor Holcomb had raised in the first half of the year, because statewide candidates have to report that on July 15th, Senator Melton won't have to report the money he's raised or spent this year until early January.
Mm-hmm. I understand it's been within the last decade or so that we've had another instance like that, in a way, come up here in Northwest Indiana about another candidate that was running for public office.
Yeah, that was one of the things I thought was notable, that in 2015, when Senator Karen Tallien decided to run for the Democratic nomination, and that same year, State Superintendent Glenda Ritz also sought to run for the Democratic governor nomination. They both converted their Senate account and State Superintendent account into a governor account really quickly after they announced the nomination. As you know, went to John Gregg, and after Tallien and Ritz dropped out, they converted their accounts back to what they were before. So it seemed a little strange that Senator Melton hasn't gone that route, but it appears under Indiana law that he is, you know, following the requirements for state campaign finance, which in this state are pretty minimal.
Now, last thing I want to ask about on this particular story, and it's just something that you may know from general knowledge, what kind of deadline would Eddie Melton have to get anything formally announced to be able to formally announce himself as a candidate for governor if he chooses to do so?
Yeah, he really won't have to start filing for the ballot. I believe isn't until January or February of 2020. So he's got plenty of time to make this decision. I'm told that he's looking at probably making some kind of decision around Labor Day. That'll be a few weeks after his listening tour ends, and that's kind of the traditional time where these decisions are made. There is already another candidate in the race, Dr. Woody Myers, who is a former state health commissioner, and we know that State Representative Carly Macer from Indianapolis is also looking at making a run, and other people still could hop in. There's plenty of time, although Governor Holcomb has $6 million in the bank to run against whoever gets the Democratic nomination, so that could scare off a few of the possible candidates.
Well, yeah, we don't have a Donald Trump in Indiana that will have that much money in the bank account to be able to go out there and throw it out and hope for the best, I suppose. So,
Woody Myers is a millionaire, and he could self-fund. Yeah, he after he was state health commissioner, he went to New York City, was health commissioner there, and invested, then served on the boards of a lot of health insurance companies and other sort of related businesses, invested in a lot of those. He's got a condo on the top floor of the Conrad Hotel, not the top floor, at the top of the Conrad Hotel in downtown Indianapolis. It's very nice.
We've only got a few minutes left here now, Dan, and I wanted to at least give you have a chance to talk a little bit about the other story that we wanted to bring up here that you had out there in the Times. This is about the latest, I guess, on Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill and the latest legal issues that are now being involved in the courts. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so a few months ago, the four women that Curtis Hill is accused of groping on the last night of the session, legislative session in 2018, filed a civil lawsuit. If you recall, last year, special prosecutor decided not to bring criminal charges against Curtis Hill because even though the prosecutor believed there was some evidence of the crime, there was probably the prosecutor determined there was probably not enough to win a conviction, especially since it would just be a misdemeanor and would have no impact on Curtis Hill from a office holding standpoint, given the lengthy fight that would probably ensue for the criminal case. So the four women involved, including State Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon, have filed a civil lawsuit against Hill as an individual and the Attorney General's office. Basically the state seeking damages and apology, policy changes, and some other things in connection with the alleged incident. Curtis Hill last week filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit. He argues that the interesting argument that because the women are employed by the legislative branch, Curtis Hill is technically an executive branch office holder, that he could not have abused his authority over them because he's not employed by them. He actually made the argument that they're essentially not, that the women technically aren't even state employees because of the uniqueness of the legislature itself as a sort of a sovereign entity. Even though everybody gets paid through the state auditor's office, their checks all say the state of Indiana. There's some legal niceties involved here that may make the case harder to pursue. It's going to be up to a federal judge who's overseeing this case. Just the other day, the Indiana House and Senate also filed motions to intervene in the case. So this sort of simple civil lawsuit is becoming quite a sort of a legal mess for everybody involved.
Yeah, I know in your story that you have some interesting comments based on what the response is that was in the court paperwork involving these lawsuits against Hill. I guess what Hill seems to think about how these things have been written up here. In particular, I like the one comment that you mentioned, which gives a little reference to the favorite kind of way that some people like to cook chicken and things like that. Of course, it's not referring to that necessarily here, but they talk about the lawsuits that are against him. Hill is saying that they're generously larded with unsupported legal conclusions. And he says that's one of the reasons why they should be dismissed. So I guess it will give some entertainment for the federal court clerks to look through that paperwork if they haven't already and chuckled at what they've seen that's already come through.
Yeah, and this is a lawsuit against the state's top lawyer, the elected lawyer representing the state. So this isn't just a business or somebody who doesn't understand the law. This is somebody who understands the law. He's a prosecutor for 16 years. Curtis Hill is going to aggressively defend himself in this instance. And I think you're starting to see, from his response to their lawsuit, the amount of work and the legal chaos that would have followed if the special prosecutor had gone ahead and filed some criminal charges against him. He's definitely going to fight this every step of the way, and you're starting to see that play out.
Well, Dan, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about these stories that you've offered up there in print and online in the Times. And obviously, we're going to get more great stories ahead. And as we get closer to the next General Assembly session, I'm sure that our lawmakers are going to come up with great ideas for things they're going to be able to put in the hopper when it's time to introduce those bills next session. And we'll probably hear more about things then, too. Dan, thank you very much for being with us today.
You got it. Thanks for reading.
Dan Carton is generally he's the State House reporter, covers the General Assembly and other issues from the Indianapolis force for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Ken Page is a psychotherapist, host of the Deeper Dating podcast, and he's the author of the bestseller Deeper Dating: How to Drop the Games of Seduction and Discover the Power of Intimacy. And he talked about the issue with Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson on how people can improve their well-being by improving their love relationship.
You suggest that people improve their well-being by improving their love relationship.
I would even say their relationships overall, and particularly like their love relationships, either finding love or keeping love. And I've got like, is all about connections, work-life balance, and quality of life.
And so tell me a little bit about that. How are people's relationships so impactful on their overall well-being? People are encouraged to do some maintenance and make sure that their relationships are in a good place.
Yeah, I think for all of us, it is a wonderful thing to do, a kind of check on how our relationships are doing. Because that's something, just like we need to look at our budget and we need to look at kind of, well, budget's a really good example, or our health and how that's doing. We need to look at our mental health and how that's doing. And the focus this year, which is the 90th anniversary of Mental Health Month, which is a wonderful concept to kind of bring awareness to people of the importance of taking care of their mental health. And this year, the theme's all about connections and quality of life and work-life balance. And connections, including connections with pets, romantic relationships, friendships, family relationships, all those things. The research is in, and it's overwhelmingly clear. The quality of our connections is just about the number absolute one most important factor affecting mental health. And, you know, with that, the quality of your spousal relationship is absolutely one of the biggest determinants of your quality of life. So I just want to say that for everyone who is in a relationship, improving that relationship might be the best thing you can do for your quality of life and mental health. And people who are looking for a relationship, if you can make some changes in the way you're looking for love, your chances of finding it become dramatically better. So those are just two big things I want to say about this. But just to kind of frame out the bigger picture of the importance of connection, there are amazing, amazing studies out there that just say kind of shocking news. Like there was one study that involved over 300,000 participants. What they looked at was social indicators of social connection, like the size of your social network, your feeling of having social support, things like that, like your sense of being connected. And they did this with over 300,000 participants. And here's what they found. If you score low on these indicators of social connection, you had a similar risk of mortality as you would have if you smoked up to 15 cigarettes a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
How do they make the connection?
Well, I think that the level of stress that you experience that might maybe lead to inflammation, and just, you know, we know that there's a huge connection between stress and physical health, as well as stress and mental health. And so though it hurts us, and we are beings that are wired for connection. When we are isolated, when we are lonely, it leads to just a tremendous amount of actual pain. I'll never forget living in New York City. There was a couple below me. They seemed to bicker a lot. They weren't so happy. They were an elderly couple. And the woman passed away. Maybe 3 months after that, I get a knock on my door. They go to the door, and it's the gentleman, a very previously kind of elegant guy. He was in his pajamas. And he looked at me with this, a very together guy. He looked at me with the most haunted eyes, standing there in his pajamas, and he said, "I'm so lonely. I can't bear it." He had never spoken to that in like a decade of living above him.
Wow.
And it just hit me. And as a psychotherapist and as someone who works in this field, I know that the pain of disconnectedness is huge. It's huge. And there's tons and tons of research that shows again and again and again that people who are in satisfying spousal relationships feel happier, have fewer problems with health, and live longer. This has been proven again and again. So this is a very important thing that we can do for our well-being, is create better social connection, including, I have to say, connection with animals, because that's a great and wonderful thing. But also, if you're someone who wants a relationship or you're someone who's in a relationship, that's something to focus on, because it really matters, and it matters for your well-being.
What are some of the ways people in love relationships can improve those relationships? And then I'd like to also know, what are some of the ways single people can find authentic love? If you want to do the first question first.
Sure. Having a happy spousal relationship is a huge, huge deal. In fact, some research has even showed that it's more important than any other element, including physical health, for determining the quality of your well-being in the world. And we know that's true. When we're with our partner and there's not a sense of communication, there's not a sense of safety, it hurts. We feel it. We shut down, we close down, we feel angry, we pull into ourselves, we get bitter. It affects us. And when we're in a relationship where there's a sense of love and acceptance, in a basic way, you get to share things, you get to have fun together, you have shared values, you have shared things that you love. Life is just, the ride is easier. The ride of life is just easier and smoother and more pleasurable, because the medium that we need to live in is a medium of connection. That's how we're built. It's how we're wired. And interesting, John Gottman, who's a wonderful researcher in the field of spousal relationships, did a study of couples that succeeded and couples that failed. And he found out that there's actually a ratio of positive to negative interactions. So he would look at couples and he would see how many of their interactions were positive. And included in positive is an ability to listen. Your partner reaches out to you about whatever, the dishes, something he or she saw on the internet, something the kids did, something that happened down the street, anything. When you miss that moment because you're focused on something else, that's what's called a lost bid. That's considered a kind of negative interaction, because your partner raised up hope and you dropped the ball. So that's an example of a certain kind of negative interaction. Of course, other ones are, and this is the killer, disdainful communication. That's the most toxic of all. But abusive communication, critical communication, all those kind of things, those are all under the category of negative interactions. Positive interactions are you catch the ball when your partner throws it. You listen. You don't judge them. You express interest. You express curiosity. You validate the good things about them. You tell them you're behind them. You tell them you've got this. You tell them what you love about them. Those are all kind of positive interactions. Even just ones that are not verbal, but are that you do the dishes or you rub their back or whatever. Well, there's a ratio of positive to negative interactions that will forecast incredibly well whether a couple's going to make it or not make it. And here's the ratio. It's 5-1. There's got to be 5 positive interactions to every negative interaction, or your relationship is in jeopardy. So the single biggest thing that you can do to affect your quality of life, in many cases, is affect the quality, enhance the quality of your couplehood. And one way to do that is to increase the positive interactions. You could think in your head, you could actually count and look. Am I 5-1? Is my partner 5-1? How can we get there? What can we do to get there? And I'll tell you one amazing thing you can do to get there. This is a simple thing, and you can find it in any gift shop. And it's a card. But it's not just an I love you card. It's a card with space in it. And what you do is you take that card and you write to your partner the things that you admire about your partner. You actually write that down, the things you admire, the things you depend on, the things you love about them, the things you respect about them, and you just kind of pour it out. You will instantly raise the kind of quality of your relationship by doing that. And that's something that every couple should do. Every time your partner does something that just seems wonderful, not just the typical, you look beautiful, but that's great too, you look handsome, but kind of the things you admire, the things you lean on in your partner, the things that other people love about them, you tell them that and watch what happens. So those are just some examples.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing, one other thing that I want to say about this, these are huge kind of tips that make a profound difference in a relationship. Well, Eli Finkel, who's a brilliant researcher in the subject of couplehood, created something that he calls the marriage hack. It's a 21-minute process that is research-proven to help your relationship from deteriorating. It's really interesting what it is. It's really simple, and it's really wonderful. And here's what it is. You and your spouse do this process. And you could just look it up on YouTube, the marriage hack, Eli Finkel, where he explains it in detail. But in essence, what it is that you and your partner both think about, in the year ahead, what do you think is the kind of conflict that's going to bog you down the most? What's the place that kind of gets you the most stuck? What's your trigger point that's kind of the worst? And you think about what that is, and then you each imagine an impartial viewer, a kind of wise, impartial viewer who wants the best for both of you and wants the best for your relationship. You imagine that person, and you imagine that person has like an inside view to the worst of the worst of that, of those problems between the two of you. Inside view to everything. And you imagine, what would this neutral, objective person who's pretty wise and wants the best for you as a couple, what would that person tell you to do? And you write down everything that person would say. Your spouse does it too. And then you read it together, and then you make a pact that those are the things you're going to work on this upcoming year around that situation. You both commit to do that. And what Dr. Finkel shows is that most relationships have a quality of communication that downgrades gradually over the years. What this does, it doesn't upgrade that, but it stops it from downgrading for the year ahead. And that's a big deal because it gives you a leg up with some of the other things I said to actually change your relationship. And the joy that brings you, the meaning, the gratification is incalculable. So these suggestions, take them on, try them out. They will change your relationship in significant ways, and that'll change your sense of well-being, and that improves your mental health.
Thank you so much, Ken. We'll definitely explore the other recommendations that you have for single people on our next conversation, but really appreciate your sharing good insights and advice with us on Mental Health Month and how to improve your well-being through relationships.
Thank you so much, Sharon. It is always a delight to be interviewed by you, so thanks for the opportunity.
It's psychotherapist, author, and podcaster Ken Page talking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District has been busy trying to educate people about not only the usual recyclables, but also about such things as household hazardous waste, and also, too, about smoke detectors. And to find out the latest, let's talk to Donna Stuckey. She's the Public Education Coordinator for the Recycling and Waste Reduction District. And Donna, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Smoke detectors are something that probably most people don't think about possibility of being recyclable, but I guess they are technically if they're handled properly. And tell us how the district based out of Valparaiso has been doing it.
Yes, well, we've marked our one-year anniversary for recycling smoke detectors. We launched this program in July of last year. And we're working in partnership with a lot of different fire departments to collect smoke detectors from residents. And we send it to a company that takes the radioactive material and sends it to a special waste fill so that radioactive material, and it's very small amount, but this way it's handled appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest the metal and the plastic from the smoke detector itself is recycled with other plastics and metals with that company. So before we had this in place, we did not have a way to recycle smoke detectors. And many times people would call us knowing that there's radioactive material in smoke detectors and asking us what they should do with it. And we basically told them, send it back to the company. But many companies couldn't really tell us what they would do with those smoke detectors once they got them or if they handled them appropriately. And personally, years ago, I called First Alert, and they basically said, I'll just throw it away because it's such a small amount of radioactive material. It's not going to be a big deal.
Well, that's not a very good idea anyway, I suppose. And, and also, too, that there's also a problem, too. I guess if you did happen to throw it in the trash, if you put it, even if you buried it in trash bags and threw that in your trash can, when the collection truck comes by on its regular route to pick up your trash, it's not a very good way to handle it anyway.
No, the radioactive material is safe if it's in the smoke detectors, but it becomes compromised when it's crushed.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in the trash business, everything is crushed. I mean, you have the trucks that go by and they crush your trash in order to make room for more. So because they've got an entire route that they have to fit in there. And then you have at the transfer stations, the semi trucks that get, that basically get filled to the rim with trash to take to the landfill. And the only way they can get as much as they can in those trucks is by crushing it down. And then of course at the landfill, they make room for more trash, so they're running it over with these bulldozers to make more room to add more trash. So, and that's when the radioactive material becomes compromised, and it can be a problem for the environment. So that's what we really want to get control of by offering this recycling program.
Now, I understand in Porter County, there are a number of locations where people can bring their expired smoke detectors to get them recycled. Tell us about those spots.
Yes. Well, yes, there are quite a few locations, as a matter of fact. We have a bunch of fire departments that are working with us, like the Chesterton Fire Department at 702 Broadway, the Porter Fire Department, 550 Beam Street, the Valparaiso Fire Department, Station 2, 2605 Cumberland Drive, the Ogden Dunes Fire Department, 111 Hillcrest Road, Lakes of the Four Seasons Volunteer Fire Force, that's 10645 Randolph Street, South Haven Fire Department, 398 West 700 North, Valparaiso, the Hebron Fire Department, 109 North Washington, and Porter EMS Station Number 3, 453 West State Road 8 in Hebron.
Mm-hmm.
And if all else fails, if you're not near any of those or if it's not convenient to go there, drop them off at any of the compost sites, the public compost sites. And we have Valparaiso, the Boone Grove compost site, and now we have the Portage compost site, which will also accept expired smoke detectors.
Now we should mention, we've been talking here about the smoke detectors, in particular the ones that have the radioactive material that is used to help detect the smoke in the air. But we're not talking about carbon monoxide detectors. And those are okay, I understand, to recycle in not necessarily the regular recyclables, but the special stuff.
Exactly. Regular carbon monoxide detectors can be recycled with our electronics program. And we have a number of places throughout Porter County that accepts all electronics, whether it be a carbon monoxide detector, a vacuum cleaner, a computer, a television, a cell phone. They can bring those to either the Valparaiso or Boone Grove compost sites. And in addition, the Portage Street Department is also accepting electronics.
Of course, the district also handles what is referred to in the business as household hazardous waste. And we have some collection days coming up soon, don't we?
Oh, yes. We've got the last three collections of the year. So if you are out there, residents of Porter County, and you've got some pesticides or some chemicals or things in your garage that you've been meaning to get rid of, there are three more collections where we will accept them. And one of them is in Hebron, and it's this weekend at Hebron Middle/High School. And we have another one coming up the following weekend at Portage High School. And those collections run 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. And, of course, the last collection of the year, which you don't want to miss if you've got these chemicals in your garage, in your sheds, in your basement, is to come to the Porter County Fairgrounds on October 12th, and we will take those chemicals off your hands. And in most cases, these materials are recycled, and if not, they are disposed of properly so they aren't an issue for the environment.
Now, we've talked here about the special recycling issues that have to be handled. And, of course, you have the still, I guess, a few of the drop-off sites out in Porter County that people can take advantage of. But there have been problems going back even into last year with some of the regular recycling drop-off locations in Porter County. Bring us up to date on how the situation is with the drop-off sites. And maybe we need a little lesson here on how to properly recycle stuff at the drop-off sites, too.
Well, we have six drop-off sites in Porter County where people can take what we call their curbside recyclables.
Mm-hmm.
So if people don't have access to curbside recycling, we're talking people that live in condos or apartments, or maybe they have a cart and it's always overflowing, they can bring those items to our drop-off sites. So these are items like paper, your plastic tubs, jugs, bottles, and jars, your cartons, your glass bottles and jars, and those kind of items, your cardboard boxes. So they're normal recyclable things that you would recycle curbside. And what we have found is that there are a number of people that you know, I don't know if they think that by leaving things on the ground that they're going to be recycled, which they won't.
Mm-hmm.
So we still find that people are leaving stuff on the ground, and whether it's in plastic bags or whether it's items that are inappropriate. Somebody recently left six office chairs.
Oh, my goodness.
That's
what places like the Restore and the resale shops are for.
Exactly, exactly. There's so many places in Porter County where these items can be taken and somebody else can use them. And if people don't know that, all they need to do is call us at 465-3694 and tell us what they're looking to get rid of, and you know, we can advise them on places that are appropriate for reuse, you know, rather than throwing it in the garbage if it still can be reused. And I think other people look at it as, well, this object has plastic in it, so, you know, we'll just take it there and they can take the plastic off of it and it'll be recycled. And that's not necessarily the case either.
Yeah.
These boxes at the beginning of the year were changed out with smaller holes so that the materials need to be put in the holes, and anything that's left on the ground is not necessarily recycled and is more than likely thrown away because our employees aren't going to rummage through bags because they don't know what's in there. And it could be material, you know, people get poked with syringes and needles and broken glass. So leaving things on the ground isn't the best way to deal with them.
And I imagine, too, that even the company that that the Solid Waste District has to pick up the materials in the drop-off site boxes is going to assume, just as you all have to, that whatever's on the ground is considered trash. And what's going to happen is, oh, maybe it'll get picked up. It'll get picked up by a trash truck. But the idea is that it means it's going to be charged to the district as trash rather than as recyclable material.
That's right. And what has happened is because of what happened with China last year, and China was our biggest consumer for recycled materials. Up to 30-40% of our materials used to go to the country of China. And China has decided that we are really, really bad recyclers. And we have been giving them a lot of trash mixed in with the product that they're buying, and they've decided they don't want to buy it from us anymore. So we as a country have to learn to become better recyclers so that we create a product that companies want and that there's a demand for. And there's no demand for, you know, giant bales of plastic with dirty diapers in there, or things that are inappropriate, toys and other stuff that's in there that people have just assumed, well, I'll throw it in the recycle bin, and somebody somewhere down the line will figure out if it's recyclable or not. Yeah. So we really need the consumers, we need residents to make that decision early in the process so that we create a product and companies will buy it, and we go through the recycle process so that we preserve our natural resources.
I was reading something the other day, too, and maybe you've seen it as well, too, that some people just assume, and for example, with plastics recycling, that you used to go by the arrows and the numbers, 1, 2, 3, whatever number it is, on the bottom of the container, and you could almost always assume that it was going to be made with that particular material. But nowadays, the plastics are getting all mixed together. The polymers are not the same, and so what may be marked as a number 2 or a number 3 may have something rather exotic in it, mixed in to make the product to begin with. And that in turn is going to make it even more difficult, if not impossible, to recycle.
Yes, exactly. So we tell people to not go by that symbol. Over the years, people assume that if it has the quote-unquote recycle symbol, that they can put it in their bin. But that is not the case. Because what is recyclable here isn't necessarily recyclable anywhere else, in Minneapolis or Indianapolis or in Florida. So those symbols are only to identify the type of material it is and not the recyclability of it, because the markets are different throughout the United States. So we tell people, as far as plastics go, it's safe to recycle tubs, jugs, bottles, and jars. And anything else, if you're in doubt, throw it away.
Yeah.
Because it's better not to compromise the rest of the plastics than to put it in the recycle bin, and it's much better being in your trash instead.
Well, I've been trying, even though I don't always find it this way because so much stuff is in plastic containers these days, I have been looking purposely for things that are made with glass jars and and trying to recycle, because those are always recyclable. As long as they're clean, they can go in the recycling container and they'll be taken up, and they'll be a good end user for that someplace. It's always pretty good as long as it's clean to work to begin with here. So I do my best to try to watch out for things, but it's difficult, and we know. And Donna, if anybody has questions, if we maybe need another primer on what to put in the recycling drop-off containers, give us the number or the way that people can contact you folks at the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction Office.
Oh, absolutely. Please call us at 465-3694. We are your Solid Waste District, and we can guide you when you're out there and you're confused on the different materials and the different products out there, because there are a lot and there's so many, and recycling isn't black and white, unfortunately. There's so many gray areas because of the different products. And we also have some tips and guidelines online, So you can visit our website at portercountyrecycling.org. And we're always happy to help.
And, of course, our friends that live in Lake County and the surrounding counties with their respective recycling districts, they can check their own particular recycling district website and find out the same information, too, because it's all the same. We're all in this big boat together, I guess, when it comes to having the right kind of materials to go out for recycling, to be sure. Donna, thank you for spending time with us to talk about it today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Donna Stuckert is the Public Education Coordinator for the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District. Two virtual charter schools embroiled in controversy could close sooner than expected. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay tells us that the school district that's overseeing the two schools says families and students have so far been left out in the dark.
The state is working to recover millions of dollars after an audit found the Indiana Virtual School and Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy artificially inflated their enrollment. But a spokesperson for the district overseeing the charters, Donna Petrates, says the Daleville School Board could vote this week to revoke the school's charters sooner than initially thought. She says the schools have sent mixed messages about whether they're still open, and she says families have struggled to access data so students can transfer or graduate.
They're closing, and students need access to their transcripts.
Petrates says the schools violated protocols from a closure agreement made this summer. It would have closed one school this fall and the second next June. But she says if the board takes action, the two virtual schools will close within the year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
Former Congressman and Munster native Todd Rokita faced some tough questions yesterday before members of the Senate in a committee that is about his bid to become a member of the Amtrak Board of Directors. Rokita voted to end public funding for Amtrak while he was a member of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. But he told the Senate committee yesterday that he favored a robust passenger train system and was just trying to send Amtrak a message to spend its allocated money responsibly. Rokita says he's been an Amtrak passenger his whole life, riding the Cardinal from Wabash College in Crawfordsville to his home in Munster, and he rode the Northeast Corridor routes of Amtrak often while he was serving in Congress. This year, the Indiana General Assembly has failed to fund the Hoosier State line, ending its run after several decades. No decision yet made on Todd Rokita's appointment to the Amtrak board. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to Northwest Indiana Times Statehouse reporter Dan Carden and also to Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson for their pieces today. And our thanks again to Porter County Waste and Recycling and Waste Reduction District staffer Donna Stuckert for her comment. Back with you on Monday.